You're listening to Episode 3 of Season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hello everyone, this is the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu. This is a show about free software, about Linux, about GNU, about Unix, stuff like that. So if you've never heard it before, get ready for a wild and crazy ride. This show is known for just its wild antics. Speaking of wild antics, this show has gotten its very first piece of hate mail. This is authorized, authentic hate mail from a listener who actually claims to be quite fond of the show. So it's one of those, oh, I like you, but kinds of hate mails. So this is very exciting for the show because I don't really feel like you're a real live podcaster until you start to receive mail that completely and utterly disagrees with you and berates you and things like that. So this was really, really cool. I have to admit, I have to confess that it wasn't actually an email, so I don't know how that means I'm sort of a real podcaster, but not yet, but really, really close, or what. It was an IRC message, but it was PM'd, so it wasn't like, it was hate mail that was a hate PM, you know, and so it wasn't something that he felt comfortable saying in public. So it was definitely sort of like drawing me aside and kind of speaking to me fairly sternly. This piece of hate mail comes from my good friend TK00. If you see him in IRC, wave, say hello to him. He told me in the PM, and I told him that I was going to use this on the show, so as far as I can tell, he'll be okay with this. Either that, or he'll be completely offended and will send me further hate PMs. But TK00 says that I was dead wrong about GNOME 3. The GNOME 3 review, he said, was just completely off base. It was extremely askew, or it skewed the truth, I guess. GNOME 3, as it turns out, is not a very good desktop. This show is not so firmly established and so brash and bold. I mean, I try to be controversial, but everything I ever say that I think is controversial, everyone emails me and says that they love it. So I don't have much of a, I don't have a very thick skin against this brand of hate mail or hate PMs. And so I'm going to cave in and just say that the official stance of this show is now that GNOME 3 is horrible. GNOME 3 is a terrible desktop. It's completely unnavigable. You can't get around it. You can never turn it off. There's no shutdown button on GNOME 3. Yeah, it's no good. Avoid it at all costs. To his credit, TK00 did say that he didn't actually use GNOME all that much either. He was more of an open box guy. Coming from if he'd said that GNOME 2 was better than GNOME 3, then I might have taken issue. But I mean, come on. Pulling out something that ends in box and saying that's a better desktop than foo, then yes, okay. What Linux geek is ever going to argue with that? Come on, give me a break. Now OpenBox versus Fluxbox, we can talk. We can have an argument against that. But yeah, you tell me that OpenBox or asterisk box is better than desktop, then it's gonna be difficult for me to really argue against that. So I kind of agree with his point there. But, yeah, I mean, what can I say? So, in all seriousness, GNOME 3, I didn't expect to like it. I apologize. I'm sorry, world. I sat down in front of it. It was pretty. It did the basics of what I needed. I like it. I mean, I hate it, is what I meant to say just then. I actually hate it. You know, and I will say also that, and I said this to TK00 in the PM as well, that I was sitting next to two people on two different separate occasions, and these are completely different people from different walks of life. One is a web developer, professionally, and one is a big, giant silver robot named Gort. And they, you know, completely different audiences, really. Now, both of them have one common thread, and that is that they use the same computer operating system that I used to use before I used Linux. If you don't know what that is, go back to a couple of seasons and listen, but I've vowed not to mention that by name during this season, so I'm not going to do it. But they used to use this very pretty and very interesting operating system, and they both saw this desktop, the GNOME 3 thing, and they both they paid attention. Like, they perked up and they were just like, oh, what is that? What how did you get it to look like that? You know, and it was kind of like, what, you're noticing my desktop? Because I'll be sitting next to people with my laptop running my wonderful KDE session with all the things that I like going on, you know, and I'll move my laptop a little bit closer to them, you know, or turn my screen towards them casually, trying to get them to notice, and no one ever pays attention. And then suddenly I'm sitting here, doing things, and they're noticing this GNOME 3 thing. So, I mean, the fact that they kind of, like, sat up and noticed really caught my attention. And I have to admit that there's a lot of conventions in the GNOME 3 desktop that really, really felt familiar to me as the former operating system user that I was. And a lot of it felt really comfortable to me. I'm not saying that it's a smart decision in the bigger scheme of things. I'm not saying that their design choices make my life more efficient or will make your life more efficient. And for that, I understand you might really, really dislike that. But if that's what they're going for, sort of like I hate though to say it's a simplified or minimal, but it's a certain style of dealing with a computer. And like I said in the previous episode, different people use their computers differently, and one has to recognize that and kind of be okay with that. Now, for the people who have lost their favorite desktop, i.e. GNOME 2, and are kind of having to be, they're kind of being forced into XFCE, I would say, gee, I'm really sorry about that. I'm sorry for your loss. But I think realistically, honestly, well, okay, realistically, I hated GNOME 2, so I don't care. But I mean, compassionately, honestly, I would say that give it a little while. You know, switch over to XFCE if you must right now. You'll probably find yourself coming back to GNOME once the feature set has been kind of reintroduced and you're more familiar with it. So, you know, I mean, if I were a GNOME 2 user hating GNOME 3 right now or being fearful of GNOME 3, I would probably just stay on an OS, on a distribution that hasn't updated to GNOME 3 yet, and just kind of chill out with GNOME 2 the last days of GNOME 2 life cycle, and when it expires at last, then take a look at GNOME 3 once the features are all there, and I'm sure they'll probably reintroduce all the stuff that you feel like you need. I mean, that's obviously me prospectively telling the future. I could be completely wrong, but that's what I'm going to anticipate, just based on the KDE 4 reaction. You know, all the KDE users have kind of been there. We've done that. Don't worry. And thank you for the PM TK009. Of course, it wasn't. He was very nice about it. So I was just trying to sound more controversial than I really am. But you know, GNOME 3, yeah, take it or leave it. I don't really care. It's just an interesting desktop. All else pushed aside, it's an interesting experiment. Apropos to the whole GNOME 3 discussion, I actually received a tip from a listener who says that my review of GNOME 3 kind of inspired him to try out GNOME 3. He hadn't really played around with it all that much before, I guess. And he found that if you're in the application selection menu or whatever, that you could start typing in your selection. I had critiqued it and said that you couldn't, sort of stepping through the different options that turn up. So obviously, if I am typing in, for instance, let's just do the whole Firefox and firewall example again on Fedora. If I type in the word fire in my little application menu, if I type in fire, then Firefox and firewall appear. Now, the tip had said that you could then use the down arrow to get out of your search box into the icons that show up as results. And then you can continue to hit the down arrow to step through. Essentially, you can go back and forth between the Firefox icon, the firewall icon, and then it takes you down to that weird Wikipedia button at the bottom and then Google. So there is a little bit of the ability to step through things. Now, I think intuitively, as he said, it would have been like the tab key. That's kind of what we're used to kind of move from a field to a different thing, and buttons, we hit tab, but it's the down arrow in this case. And it works. I've confirmed it. So if you type in fire, and then you get Firefox and firewall, you're in your search box. Stop typing, just hit the down arrow, and then you're in Firefox. Hit it again, You're in Firewall. Hit it again. You're on Wikipedia button, so you can search for fire for whatever weird reason that would be. And Google, you could search Google for fire. Again, totally bizarre, I think, but whatever. So yeah, there's a little bit of maneuvering there. And the funny thing is that I don't know anyone who knew that. You know, I haven't spoken to anyone yet who told me about that. And a lot of people had complained about it and never really let on that they knew about this down arrow thing. And and you'd think that that would infuriate you or make you angry or offend you. Think that, oh, that's not intuitive. It's not good. People can't just discover this stuff for themselves. And while there's totally an argument for that, I'm a sucker for intuitiveness. I'm a sucker for designing interfaces that just kind of lead you down the path very naturally based on things that you already know, whatever, or things that they've already established within themselves, so self-referential intuitiveness. I'm a sucker for that. I love it. There's a huge argument toward it. And yet, there's something in me, and I think it harkens back to that old OS, that I can actually respect the idea that the only way to learn some of the power user tricks is to hear about it from other users. I realize that that's completely stupid. And it goes against like everything that anyone ever talks about when they're designing an interface. Oh, let's make an interface that no one will really know more than the basic usage unless they just happen to be in the club and they get the tips from the people who have happened to discover them. And they're kind of like the grassroots spreading of, oh, here's how you can be a power user of GNOME 3 or of this operating system or whatever. I mean, it's really like people don't like that, but that's kind of the world I came from, to be honest. The users who were using the operating system that I used to use, 98% of them had no idea how to open a folder in a new window or how to launch applications without going to the application folder or just whatever. So many people have no clue about little tips like that. And yet, if you meet someone who does know all those cool tricks, then you are kind of inducted into like this elite club of power users who can actually navigate the interface without taking your hand off the keyboard, for instance. So it's stupid, and it's mean, and it's not cool, and it's not intuitive, and it's counterintuitive, and it hinders progress and everything along those lines. And yet there's something to it. There's something kind of respectful to it. And if you dig deep enough and you start sharing tips with other people, then it can propagate itself. So I don't know. There's something there, I think, is what I'm trying to say. It doesn't completely offend me that I could never figure out the stupid down arrow trick and had to be told about it from some random person who, by the way, is named Tim, aka Pseudomorph. So for more GNOME 3 tips, hit up a guy named Pseudomorph, and also let me know about any tips that you find, and this will just become like the GNOME 3 Power User Fan Club podcast in no time. Let's see, I also got an email, not completely indirectly, it was actually an email correspondence with Dan Washko and Link Fesden from the Linux Link Tech Show, of course. They were talking about Mutt on the previous episode of Tilts, or... well, it's not previous by the time you'll hear this episode, but at one point they were talking about Mutt. And I remember Link had said that he'd found out that you could use an external SMTP server. You didn't actually have to have a server installed, you know, on the computer that you were using Mutt or that you were pointing Mutt at. And I thought that the workaround I had discovered for my computer was a little program called MSMTP. And MSMTP is, from what I gather, it's almost a bridge, or I guess you could almost call it a proxy maybe, or a redirect, and you can tell your computer that as your SMTP program, you want to use MSMTP, and then you tell MSMTP that the SMTP user, the SMTP server you want to use is, you know, I don't know, smtp.google.com or whatever. So that was what I was using. Not Google, of course, as my server, but I mean, you get the idea. I was using my own external SMTP server. I think I'm using kernelpanicodcast.net, I think. And MSMTP is the program that Mutt is aware of. Well, it turns out that you don't even have to do that. At some point in Mutt's life, they have created an option that you can place in your MuttRC file, and the option is pretty simple. It's simply set space SMTP underscore URL equals SMTP colon slash slash SMTP dot whatever dot net. So, regardless of what server you want to send email from, you can now set it that simply in your MUD-RC file. So thank you very much, Link, for that tip, because all this time I've been using MSMTP, apparently not actually needing to do that. So that was really cool to learn about. I think on a fairly recent episode, I mentioned something called convergence. Convergence is an up-and-coming alternative to SSL. You may or may not know that SSL is fairly well embedded in the kind of enterprise server space. I mean, if you're a server and you're on the internet and you're a business, then you probably have an SSL certificate. And I think in theory SSL, I'm sure at one point in theory it was great. I'm sure it was the most brilliant thing ever. In theory, it is still a good idea, I think. And keep in mind, I'm no security expert or anything like that, but I know what I know and I know what I feel. And I'm feeling like SSL has kind of reached a point where it's no longer quite as valid as it used to be. So SSL is kind of based on the idea at some point it boils down to whether or not you could afford an SSL certificate that people's browsers will silently accept. Now, what do I mean silently accept? Well, let's back up and come up with a scenario here. So if I've got a blue server running Fedora and a brown server running Ubuntu, I put them both on a network. I give the Fedora the address 192.168.1.1. I give the Ubuntu box the address 192.168.1.19. There's two different servers. They're two physically different boxes. One's Fedora, one's Ubuntu. Okay, now I walk into this network with my laptop, I sit down, and someone tells me, the file that you want is on that blue box right over there, and the address is 192.168.1.1. So I SSH into it, or I sign on to it in my web browser, whatever they've set up for me. I go to 192.168.1.1. There's the Fedora start page. It looks good. It looks like it's Fedora. I grab the file that they say that I want, and I use the file. Everything's great. I go home. Overnight, while I'm not there, someone comes in and changes around the setup, and they assign that Ubuntu box with a new IP address, and it's 192.168.1.1. That used to be the Fedora box's IP address, right? Well, we've just changed it. Let's watch and find what happens. So then I come in the next day, I sit down with my laptop, and I think, okay, so I need another file off of that Fedora box today. I know the IP address, so I'll just sign on again. So I go 192.168.1.1. Guess where I am now? I'm on the Ubuntu box. But the person who's changed the IP address has been very clever, and they've changed the start page on that Ubuntu box to a Fedora page, and they've put files on there that I would expect to see. So I SSH into it, or I HTTP over there, and everything looks normal. It's the normal start page. It looks familiar. I'm pretty sure I'm on the same box. I mean, it's sitting right there. It's blue. Yesterday they told me that it was 192.168.1.1. Surely it wouldn't have changed. Everything looks right. There's all the files that I saw yesterday. It looks pretty familiar. Well, I'll just grab that other file that I forgot to get yesterday, and I'll start using it. So you see the issue here, right? The problem has been that there's really no way to tell what computer you're on, especially if someone goes to any amount of trouble to make it look like you're on the same computer. If this was a malicious thing happening behind my back, then this could get really, really ugly really, really soon, because I've established trust in that blue box. I've met the system administrator of that box. He assured me that that was the IP address. I went there. To my human brain, it looks exactly this. You know, I saw it. I recognize the files that are there. I recognize the design of the site, whatever. And all it took was someone to go behind my back and change the IP addresses, do a couple of different modifications to the brown Ubuntu box, and suddenly I think I'm on the same computer. Now, if they've placed a file there that I think is healthy and safe to use, but actually it contains malicious code, now I'm in trouble. So what SSL does is it assigns, from what I understand, it's very similar in concept to, for instance, SSH keys or GBG keys, things like that, where SSL, you are able to install a little certificate onto that blue box. When I first go to that blue box, I can get a copy of that certificate. I can identify that that box has this certificate, and so I know that that certificate belongs to that box. And so now I've established that I've contacted this blue server, and that it's running Fedora, and that it has files that for whatever reason I've decided I can trust. Then if I'd gone home, someone did the switcheroo on me, I came back the next day, I sign into the blue box, in air quotes, And suddenly my computer warns me, hey, this isn't the box we were talking to yesterday. The SSL certificate's not there, or it's missing. Something's up. Then I know, maybe I should do a little bit of an investigation. Maybe I should find out what server I'm really on. Maybe I should contact the sysadmin and ask, hey, did you switch out your SSL cert? Because yesterday I got one and today it's trying to give me something else. So that's the theory behind SSL. In order for that to really work smoothly, we need something to alert us if there is a difference in SSL certificate, right? You're not going to want to go in and manually download the certificate and then do a diff on the two certificates or something like that. That's a little bit troublesome. So it's built into the browsers, and the browser will alert you, or let's just say the browser would alert you if that SSL certificate was different than the first one that you'd gotten, or whatever. In practice, what happened is that a group of companies came in and said, well, we're going to start selling these SSL certificates, and we're going to earmark these little certificates. And so these certificates will be branded, essentially. So they are selling these certificates, people are putting them on their servers, and then the browsers, the web browsers, have a certain set of SSL certificate brand names, essentially, that they will blindly accept as safe certificates. Which boils down to pretty much, oh, this certificate came from VeriSign. Well, gee, nobody evil ever buys a VeriSign certificate. This server must be okay. And that's the model of trust that OpenSSL essentially is based on today. And I say essentially, and I say more or less, and I say kind of, because it's all very, I think it's fairly hazy, because in theory, a careful user, a user who actually pays attention, could really use this to their advantage. You know, they could look at the SSLs, they could pay attention to errors that their web browsers are throwing at them, and they could see when a certificate has changed, and they could decide whether they want to do a little bit of background checking on this company or on this site before they go blindly accepting that it's a trusted company and that they can download and interact with that website. Unfortunately, a lot of users don't do that because we don't really teach users to at all have any clue as to what any of that means. They just see errors in Firefox, they press the view the exception button and confirm security exception, and then they go on with their life. At least that's what the users around me do. I don't know exactly who taught them how to do that, actually, but they do it. I've seen it many, many times. Other people, I don't know what they do. Maybe they just navigate away from the site and just never go there, or maybe they just use a different browser for that one site. I don't know. But the point is that I know that most people don't understand what SSL is. They don't understand where SSL certificates come from, or what they're really trusting or confirming or anything like that. To confuse matters further, and yet also to improve the situation simultaneously, there was a little bit of a movement for a while called CA certs, which isn't CA certs, but CA certs. I think it was cacert.org specifically. And this was kind of a communal certification authority, so that you could generate your own SSL certificate, and then you would get groups of people to sign your certificate as a trusted certificate. So you would sort of build up a ring of trust, very, very similar to GPG keys. And this was a really good idea, I think. And I'd been looking for a while on getting something like that started with, you know, a local group, and it never really panned out for me, but I think that's at least it's taking the trust, the authoritative trust, out of the hands of one big company that's just selling SSL certificates, and you just have to assume that no one evil ever goes to the trouble of buying an SSL certificate. That doesn't work out for me. So CA cert, at least I know that these five friends of mine have signed off on this certificate, and this certificate is being signed off by these other people, and so on. So that I feel a little bit better about. The problem is that the browsers don't necessarily have any real awareness of the cacert.org model. And so what ends up happening is that if you have a CA cert, you're always flagged by the browser as being a suspicious site, a site that is not signed by VeriSign or by whatever other company out there is selling their seal of approval. To the normal user, of course, that looks basically the same as when the browser tells them, hey, the certificate that was perfectly valid or judged perfectly valid by this one company yesterday is suddenly different today. What do you want to do? It looks no different. Either way, you have to confirm this security exception. You don't even know what you're looking at. You do something with a view certificate or something. You click the buttons until the message goes away, and then you're finally on the stupid website that you were going to. So, on one hand, it improves the situation because now the admins are no longer required to rely on this company to sell them a sealed approved SSL certificate, and yet it complicates it because now to the dumb users, it looks basically all the same, and all that it looks like to them is that their web browser is giving them an error, which probably just means that they should update to the latest browser. That's probably all that means. Or it's a network error, and it'll fix itself after a while. And it does, because they click until it goes away, and then they've confirmed this security exception, and it never pops up for that site again. Implying that we need a new model. Implying that a new model doesn't already exist. It does exist. It's called convergence. And I think I mentioned this on a couple of episodes back, but I'm mentioning it again with more information. Convergence.io is the site, convergence.io. It is put out by Moxie Marlinspike, who is kind of a fairly well-known SSL hacker. And this is the alternative to SSL, because convergence doesn't rely on this kind of central certificate authority. It relies on a ring of trust from the beginning. And happily, they have a little Firefox plugin that you can install, and I have installed quite some time ago and have been running it for quite some time now, and it's really nice. The plugin, the add-on itself, is just downloadable straight from the site. So if you go to convergence.io, you'll see a green download button down near the bottom of the page. It will install automatically into Firefox, and you can restart Firefox, and then it will be part of the Firefox interface. It's just a little lock with two plus marks by it up in the right corner of your Firefox window. If you click on it and go to options, you'll see all the different kind of back-end options that you have to kind of become a part of the convergence system. So the idea behind convergence is that you sign up with certain notaries. And you could think of notaries, or at least I think of them, almost as very equivalent to the ad blocking community. You know, if you've got Adblock Plus installed in Firefox, then you need to get some kind of list of known sites that serve ads. And so you join like this list of ad blockable sites. And once you've done that, then you don't really have to worry about what sites you need to add to your blockable list, and you kind of just get served that sort of thing from this list that you've joined. It's similar in convergence. You assign a notary, or you add a notary to your convergence ring of trust, as it were, and if they have marked a site trusted or questionable or not trusted at all, then you will inherit those levels of trust from that notary. Now, you can have lots of different notaries. You could add any number of notaries that you trust. Similar to GPG, this actually becomes a stronger system the more notaries we have. So you can actually run your own notary server. It's available as free software from convergence.io. You can download the server software and install that on your public server node, and you can mark sites trusted and untrusted or questionable. People can add you as a notary, and so if you trust this site, you know, this site has been marked as trusted. Now, you can set your level of trust in the notaries as well. You could say in the options panel of convergence, you can say to verify a server as, you know, ultimately trusted by you, you can require the notary consensus, you can require notary majority, which is the default, or you can require just one notary's okay. If one person that you know says, yeah, I've been to this site, I trust it, then you can say that that's okay. I've kept it on default so far, require notary majority. Of course, I only have the two default notaries so far. I don't know of any notaries outside of those two that exist. But again, that's kind of the strength of the model. As more notaries pop up, the more sites you'll have as being marked as verified. And of course, you have control over your notaries. So now, rather than just saying, well, if VeriSign sold them a certificate, then surely they must be okay. Now you're saying, well, if my friend over on the East Coast says that they're an okay server, and if Moxie Marlinspike says they're okay, and my other friend over on the West Coast says that they're okay, then I think that I'm going to go ahead and trust this server, because, I mean, if I can't trust those guys, then who can I trust? And so you're okay. So I think it's a much better model. It's obviously distributed, right? It doesn't rely on these couple of companies who, you know, I mean, I don't even trust them anyway. I don't know anyone who works at VeriSign. I don't know what they're interested in. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know how they check on things. I know that I've been at a company and I was in charge of buying the SSL certification, so I kind of know the check that goes through, but it was a pretty well-known company, so I'm assuming that, maybe there was a level of familiarity there because they didn't really do a whole lot to check on, identity. You just put down your money, and it was a lot of money. Maybe that had something to do with the ease of obtaining the certificate. And then you're in. You're marked okay by VeriSign, and so you get marked by default by everyone's browser, no matter what. It's kind of goofy. So this is much more distributed than that. You can have notaries all over the place. You can choose your own notaries. There's also an agility to this convergence thing, meaning that you can quickly and easily turn off and turn on notaries. If you suddenly have a falling out with someone and you realize that they're into stuff that you're just not into, or that they're acting really suspicious lately and they've stopped signing their GPG email signature anymore, then you can drop them from your notary list. No worries. And finally, according to their own page, it's simple. And honestly, I have to say it is. You go to their site, you download the plugin, it adds itself to your Firefox toolbar. By default, it's got pretty sane settings. You know, it requires the majority of your notary trust. It's got two notaries there that are, I think, pretty good. I mean, ThoughtCrime, which is Moxie's little organization, and I think Convergence itself. So that's probably basically the two same notaries. But as I say, more notaries will appear, I hope. I plan on looking into running one myself, so at least there will be two notaries. If you want to run one as well, that would be great. You know, and start building this ring of really, you know, it's kind of the open source model, right? It's the software model that we're all using already. And that is that there shouldn't be one entity saying, okay, here's what everyone's going to trust, here's what you choose to accept as correct and not correct, and otherwise we're going to throw all kinds of exceptions and errors at you and your users and scare everyone away or whatever. This is a much more sane, I think, solution to the idea of, okay, we're out on the internet, we have no idea what server we're on, at some point we have to break down and start trusting someone. At least now you can choose who you get to trust. So convergence.io, it's a very cool idea, it's a very cool system, it's an easy little plugin to use. If you use Firefox, and I'll bet most of the listeners probably do, then you've got a nice little plugin just for your browser. You can essentially get off the CA cert system. Wow, what's really great is that I got here really early this morning and someone had brought in bagels, including a salt bagel. So I'm eating a salt bagel right now and countering that stinging, salty sensation in the mouth with a nice sip of hot coffee. It is a sublime sensation, wonderful taste. If you've not tried this, you have to try it. But no time now, let's get back to the show. Okay, so I feel like we had a lot of very serious discussion there about, you know, hate mail and, well, Mutt was fun, but SSL being broken beyond repair. And Convergence was fun too, but still, it's been a roller coaster ride so far, and I did warn you at the beginning of the episode. But now we're gonna just pull back, we're gonna sit down, we're gonna talk about something fun. The thing that I wanna talk about is GIMP Paint Studio. GIMP Paint Studio sounds like some kind of remix of GIMP, right? Sounds like someone took the GIMP code, redid it, and made some kind of new version of GIMP. Well, it's none of those things. It is, however, a really nicely packaged GIMP add-on of sorts. And it's kind of a hacked-in add-on. It's not even something that they really had to write code for. It's a really great, neat project, and it really kind of makes me think of the multimedia sprint that we did last year or so, and that I'm trying to get going again very soon. But it kind of reminds me of that, because basically it's just a guy or a group of people, I'm not sure how many contributors there are, but you know, actually it looks like there are three. So there's Miranda Graphics and then two contributors. So there you go. Three people got together, sat down, came up with some really cool presets for different brushes and some different shapes and different compositing presets. All these kinds of things for brushes that you can load into the GIMP. And if you do this in an organized way, and if you really do it with care, then suddenly you've got 30 paintbrushes compiled together that you've created. You can package them together as a GIMP Paint Studio and release it to the world, and that's basically what these people did. So if you go to code.google.com/p/GPS, just like Global Positioning service thing or whatever it is, GPS-GIMP-Paint-Studio, you will be greeted by a very attractive graphic. It's really, really nicely done, and it's a code hosting page for really all it is, like I've said, is a set of presets for paintbrushes in GIMP. The way that this manifests itself, so if you download this thing and unzip it into some directory somewhere on your computer, you'll see inside the directory a set of brushes, gradients, palettes, patterns, some tool options, and I think a menu configuration or something like that. These things you can copy into your /.gimp whatever. It'll be like a -2.6 probably, but it could be something else in theory. You want to copy the brushes into /brushes, the gradients into /gradients, palettes into /palettes, patterns into /patterns, and then I think tool options into tool options, or there might not even be a tool options yet, I don't exactly remember, and then all the RC files into the main .gimp folder. So you'll get a menu RC, I think a doc RC, a plugin RC, a tool RC, I'm pretty sure. So a couple of different little RC configuration files in there. So first of all, obviously, if you install this thing, you're going to be overwriting your personal configuration files for GIMP. So if you've modified the layout of GIMP a whole lot, changed the look and feel of it, whatever, don't do this blindly. Back up your old configuration files, try this, and then restore whatever you need to restore, or redo whatever you need to redo. I use GIMP a lot, and I have made a couple of different modifications to the interface, but it wasn't anything I couldn't re-implement in a trivial amount of time, so I just nuked my old ones and wrote right over them with the new ones. So to install, like I say, all you do is download the zip file and zip the file into a folder, and then copy everything from that folder into the corresponding places on your system. So that would be /.gimp-2.x, where x is the version of your, you know, it's 2.4, 2.6, 2.7, whatever you're running, and into the corresponding folders. If you don't want to do all that, you can download a very simple, ridiculously simple, installer script that I wrote. I wrote a magazine article about this kind of thing. I forget if it was, I don't think it was exclusively on GIMP Paint Studio, but it mentioned that in the article. So as an additional download, you could download this install script at klaatu.fedorapeople.org. Download that, chmodx the script. Make sure you have wget installed, because it's going to wget GIMP Paint Studio for you if you don't have it. And then execute the script, and it'll download it, unzip it, and then copy everything to where it needs to be copied. If you don't want to do it that way, which by all means you don't have to, it's very easy to do, you can simply do all that yourself. Place everything in the brushes folder in your .gimp-2.x/brushes folder. Everything in the gradients in your /.gimp-2.x/gradients, and so on, including all the config files. And then either quit GIMP or launch it if it's not running yet. Either way is okay. And you'll be greeted with the same old GIMP pretty much as you're used to, except that the layout will be a little bit different, and there'll probably be some palettes that you're fairly unfamiliar with. These aren't really anything new, they're just a lot better, that they have more stuff in them, they're better organized, a better layout, more or less, and a bunch of brush presets that will probably blow your mind. So if you, I'm sitting in front of GIMP right now, I'm gonna make a new image, and then if you get into the brush palette where you select your brush shapes and everything like that, right away you'll see a whole bunch of new brushes that you've never had before. So that's a good start right there. But the problem with brushes, I find, is that they're kind of, they're all very digital looking, right? Even when you get something with a little bit of variety to it, it feels like you're painting pixels and not really painting with a paintbrush, you know? It always seems very, very cold and calculated. Well, if you look into the tool options palette, which is not your brush palette, it's the one that dynamically changes with each different tool that you use. So if you've got a brush active as your active tool, then the tool options will give you all the tool options for the brush. If you have a marquee selected, then your tool options will give you the different rectangle select options, and so on. So this is specifically called the tool options palette, and at the bottom of the tool options palette, there's a little nondescript button, and of course it's going to look different depending on how your system is themed and stuff like that. But this, it's just this kind of small, non-distinct button. If you roll over it long enough, it's the second one to the left. It's called Restore Options From. And that's what the GIMP Paint Studio people are using as the place to find all of the cool new brushes that they've basically invented for GIMP. These things are absolutely incredible. So you can be on any brush that you want as long as you're in the brush tool, and then go to the Tool Options palette and select Restore Brush From, or Restore Options From, and choose your, just pick your poison. I'll run down a small list of the samples. They've got a 2B pencil, a 2B pencil grain, graphite shades, blue school pen, it's like a ballpoint pen, pin brush, normal brush, palette brush, oil brush, soft oil, glow lights, glow darks, beam light, dust, normal dust, rough dust, texture, scratches, and that's just in the basic brush templates. Then they have Cini basic round, Cini thin pencil, Cini chalk, eroded brush, rake, hard brush, dirty brush, big grain, splatters, and then they've got different effect brushes. They've got glares, nebula, funky, hellfire, fire effects, fire and smoke, ignition fire, rocket fire, particles fire, and then they've got sketching pencils of all different sizes, 2B, 6B, graphite, grain, angled, sharp, not sharp, black grass, graphite, and then they have effects nature. They have noise scratch, dirty spot, leaves, foliage, grass, clouds, rock, mountains, line texture, techno, tubes, mecha stuff, chain, a kid's crayon, a big crayon, dirty crayon green, star gradient, it's incredible some of the stuff that they have. And what's even more incredible than just going down the list and reading them like that is actually using them. The things are just beautiful. They're just astonishing. If you start drawing with some of these things, you'll feel like you just purchased a new application. And believe me, there are applications out there that people spend a lot of money on to try to emulate these materials. And it's really kind of funny to just grab these from some random Google code page and realize that you've just gotten material emulation, and they specialize in doing just that and making your creations look less digital and more natural, more organic. This is the place to go. This is an incredible, incredible set of brushes. It's free, open source. You can contribute if you've got something that you've done a preset for. It's a great little project, and really just kind of came out of nowhere for me. I don't remember exactly where I heard about it. I'm going to just kind of throw out a guess and say it's Fedora Art Team probably told me about it, but I could be wrong. At the same time, I'm not really sure. This, combined with something like the multimedia sprint where we put together all those different brushes that we'd collected from all over the place, it literally makes your GIMP into a completely different application. It's no longer just limited to photo retouching. It's now an illustration program. I mean, it's still bitmap, obviously, but I think even the really nice paint programs, quote unquote paint programs, even those are bitmap. The vector stuff is really not considered a materials emulation engine usually. It's usually much more about bitmap and calculating the different effects that one material would have on another. It's really, really cool stuff. It's a lot of fun to play around with, especially some of those effects brushes where, you know, you don't even have to know what you're doing, and you just turn on some fire or something, and suddenly you're drawing these streaks of fire across your picture. It's really, really cool. So I urge you to check it out. It's a tiny download, because all it is are some random text files that you copy over onto your home folder. So it's a tiny download, and it's a super easy install. And if you can't do it yourself, then go grab my install script. It'll do it for you. And you're painting and drawing with pencils and pens and fire and smoke, all kinds of cool effects. Really, really quick way to sort of pimp your GIMP. I guess that could be like a catchphrase or something. So yeah, have fun with GIMP Paint Studio. So speaking of painting and studios and free software and stuff, one thing that Blender does really well and pretty famously, is compositing. And compositing is simply the act of taking two objects. They may be things that occur in real space, or they might be things that you've completely generated on the computer, and putting them together to make it seem like they are in the same space. That's something that Blender does. It's something that people know that it does, and it gets a little bit of attention for that sort of thing, but not quite as much, I feel, as it does for the 3D modeling stuff. That doesn't make compositing and sort of that world of motion graphics any less valid than 3D modeling, of course. It just means that it's not getting quite as much attention. But I figured that one area that Blender really, really excels in, I mean, aside from 3D modeling, is that compositing and motion graphic realm. Now, motion graphics, when I say that, I mean, for instance, if you've ever seen one of those fancy title sequences at the beginning of movies where you see real objects and they've got words on the side of them, and those words turn out to be, oh, those are the credits. Or maybe you're speeding along a space or a road, and the titles are coming right at you, and then suddenly you're past the titles, and you've gone through all of these things and past them and stuff like that. You've probably seen almost, I guess I would say, interactive title sequences for movies. Or maybe you've seen just something as basic as a slate or a logo. You know, you've got, a big triangle and some text, and they're flying together, and they crash into each other, and they make a little explosion, and then the words of the name of the company falls out and appears, and then some big sound happens, and then you're onto the next frame. You're onto the movie or something. You know, slates at the beginning of movies. Whatever. Or commercials. You've got computer-generated razor blade, and the name of the company flies across, and you hear a big explosion, and you see the guy, and he's saying how great the razor blade is, and how manly it is to shave with that particular razor blade. Really exciting stuff, motion graphics. So motion graphics is something that you actually see a lot more than you might even realize, and now that I've mentioned some uses, you might be thinking of them, but, you know, there are things that you can't necessarily photograph, or you can't photograph, because words just don't float around in the sky usually. So you have to create them. And the place that you can create them would be, well, traditionally for a lot of people, it would be like After Effects or motion or something like that. But for the free software people like us, a great place to create them is Blender. And this isn't one of those weird Blender hacks that I like to talk about, like, oh, let's edit video in Blender like me and maybe one other person in the world does. Well, and I don't even have to do it anymore, so it's just that one sucker who hasn't discovered Cadian Live yet. But this is like one of those things that Blender actually was designed to do. They knew that they were going to be, this was something that they understand. They're like, yes, we can do this. We can generate text. We can have it float in the air. We can have it cast a shadow. We can have another object come along and fly into the text and cause the text to explode, whatever. Particle emulation, that's another, actually. And I guess that's kind of more or less compositing as well, but not really. It's more like motion graphics. Maybe you want, something as simple as someone a blacksmith having a hammer hitting an anvil. You want sparks to fly all over the place, and the sparks didn't quite come out in real life. They didn't quite photograph as well as you would have liked. Bring it into Blender. Generate some sparks. You're done. So, big area. This is a big, important area, because a lot of people in the real world, they only know to turn to After Effects, and that's the interface that they're used to. It's familiar-ish to them. It's got the all-important familiar logo that starts with an A, and they like it. They're comfortable there. That doesn't mean that they're not familiar with Blender. It doesn't mean that they're afraid of Blender. It just means that they don't know Blender yet. So I figured it would be a really, really good thing to do some video casts of Blender tutorials and not talk about 3D modeling at all. Because 3D modeling scares people. Heck, it scares me. 3D modeling is for a very specific group of people. And that group of people, they can do that. They can model. They can take a lump of clay and they can mold it into a shape that looks recognizable and has maybe even some function. I'm not one of those people. I can't do that in real life, and I cannot do it in virtual space. So 3D modeling, while Blender is fantastic for it, and I know because I've tried it and I've played around with the tools, and it really is very incredible. But it's just like if you limit Blender to be just a 3D modeling application, then you're sort of cutting off half of its intended use. And I don't feel like the 3D graphics side of Blender gets as much attention as it should. And I feel like ignoring it weakens the program. And ignoring it also kind of miscategorizes the program. Because people look at Blender and they think automatically, that's a 3D modeling program. Don't need it. Don't want it. Whereas if they have heard of Blender in the light of it being a 3D modeling program, a compositor, and a motion graphic generator, then that becomes something that they might be interested in. To speak nothing of the fact that, hey, it's free. They can grab it for any computer that they're on. They don't never have to worry about getting the license code for that other program that they would have gone to instead. So it's quite powerful. So the videocasts on Blender will be available very soon. I'm going to have a link to the first 4 or 5 episodes in the show notes. And from there, I've got outlines for about 5 other episodes, so there ought to be about 5 more episodes after that, and we'll see where it goes after those, you know, that initial 10 episodes. I don't intend it to be a complete guide to everything you can do in Blender in terms of motion graphics, but I so far I've gotten fairly far along by the 5th episode, so we'll see what happens. It's something I'm doing in my spare time. We'll see how far I can go with it. But either way, I think they're pretty good. So check them out if you have any interest in that sort of thing at all. Or, you know, recommend them to friends if you know people who are interested in that kind of thing. That's about all I've got for you today, I think. So thank you very much for listening, and of course you can always contact me on the interwebs a couple of different ways. There's email, klaatu@member.fsf.org. There is Jabber, not klaatu@jabber.org, and there's Freenode. And I'm usually not klaatu on Freenode in the, for instance, Oddcast Planet channel, in the Slacker Media channel, lots of other Linuxy channels. And you can find the website at oddcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
I'm the man who's gonna burn your house down with the lemons!